listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the talking heads waited with bated breath on Friday for the release of the Democratic memo, which as of midday Friday was still on President Trump's desk, according to reports, it appears that the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Devin Nunes, is leaning towards a full disclosure of the FISA application, which he says shows that the Obama administration hid the fact that Democrats paid for the so-called Trump dossier when making an application for a FISA warrant to eavesdrop on then-Trump campaign advisor Carter Page.
Well, it's pretty clear that the American people have a right to know if there are FISA abuses. So if an American is being spied on using foreign intelligence capabilities of the United States of America, and it's wrong, and we discover that, we have to expose it. It's a very dangerous place to go because you will be releasing sources and methods. Okay, there's going to have to be a lot of things done. First of all, I think the FISA court needs to hold some of these folks in contempt, which they can do, right? They basically lied to the court. They knew that the Democrats and the Hillary campaign had funded it, and that should have been front and center before a court, right? If I'm a judge, and I think all American citizens can agree, if you're going to go to a secret court and get a warrant on a campaign, the first thing that they ought to be clear about is, hey, judge, we just want to let you know the other campaign paid for this. You had one campaign, the Hillary Clinton campaign, working in conjunction with the Democratic National Committee, dug up dirt on Donald Trump that was phony dirt, gave it to the FBI, who then opened an investigation, a counterintelligence investigation, using our intelligence agencies to spy on an American citizen. It's really that simple. What happened is the FBI presented the dossier as if it was true. And then they used a news article to corroborate this dossier, the dirt. But what they didn't say is that Steele, who wrote this, who wrote the dossier, also briefed the reporters. So you basically have and Steele was hired by the Hillary campaign. Either they didn't know, which would be bad, or they did know and they lied to the court. They actually went to great lengths to not tell anyone that the Democrats had paid for this and the Hillary campaign had paid for this. They went to such great lengths that they developed, there's a footnote that's still classified, but it's buried way deep, that you'd have to do, you'd have to basically come up with, you'd have to do word math to try to put it all together to come up with that. It's basically designed, what I believe, to disguise the fact that the Democrats and the Hillary campaign paid for the dossier. So I find it very difficult to believe that the Department of Justice and FBI are going to be able to run this investigation themselves into everything that happened here. Because remember, this is only in phase one of this investigation dealing with FISA abuse. There's much, much more to come.
With dueling memos and soon-to-be dueling special prosecutors showing deep divisions inside the intelligence community, the government in general, and among the elites, we spoke with Professor Ward Churchill, author of the COINTELPRO papers, and asked if there were any historical precedents for the current situation. Is there any historical precedent to this kind of game? Because it seems, I remember all of the stuff with Nixon and with the CIA and the FBI, and some of the things that were going on earlier than that. I was born in 1954, so, the things that I saw from 1962 on, that history, I'm kind of pretty familiar with. I don't know anything like this, where there are these factions that, are making competing presentations and speaking through factions in the government with, I've got these top secret pieces of information from the intel community as opposed to I've got those. Have you ever seen anything like this, or is there a historical precedent for this?
Not literally, although you would see some of that in the post-World War II. Era where before McCarthy stands up and says, his famous list of however many names,
communist
was
State Department,
working in the government,
right?
Okay, and then with Parnell, Thomas, and HUAC, and Nixon's right. Rise in that, and they're making all sorts of allegations about the Republican administration, about the Democratic administrations, right. Really all through the 30s and right through the war, and including by implication, the Truman administration that was in power at the time. And you got some responses, but not like the ones that are going on now.
Yeah. Okay. And not for nothing, while that was going on, Truman is passing the National Security Act and, creating the CIA and all this stuff.
The loyalty oath program. And
yeah.
All of that. So again, there is a sort of a consensus, if you will. I mean, the accusations going back and forth. Essentially, the right wing of the Republicans was claiming that communist agents were running the State Department and so forth, and that was certainly being denied.
Right.
But it was a different sort. Than is the case now, and some of that may, in fact, be that publications were publications in those days, and you needed to have either control of a newspaper or be running some little rag that a couple hundred people read, or control of a radio station, which was pretty tightly controlled. TV wasn't even a major factor yet, as compared to what you have now with the blogosphere and all of that nonsense. So you've had the rise of that in the level of chatter, which is to say, in a way, distraction from what's actually going on. Mm. Okay? And there are political things going on, repressive things, COINTELPRO, if you will. Mm. Current example, the real deal. Not the stuff that's contrived about who's doing what to whom with inside the institutional box, but the thing that's going on with Black Lives Matter and other organizations being lumped together under the heading of black identity extremists.
Right.
That's okay, right. Which is kind of like black nationalist hate groups. That was the caption that was used during COINTELPRO itself secretly,
right.
Okay, until that stuff was disclosed in the 1970s. That was their, in their cryptonymic operation that was being carried out, COINTELPRO itself.
Wow.
All right. Yep. Well, you've got a guy now who's facing 10 years in Dallas for speech activities, captioned a black identity extremist because he is prominent in the Huey P. Newton Gun Club, which is simply a black organization drawing on a history of Second Amendment claims by so-called black nationalist hate group, Black Panther Party, named for the head of the Black Panther Party, came up with the police thing, availing themselves of legal rights to carry unconcealed weapons in California.
Right.
The law got changed as a result of their availing themselves of their rights. He's drawing on that tradition in the black community, and part of Black Lives Matter, too, as far as I can tell. He's facing 10 years simply for possession of two perfectly legal weapons. He is a convicted, he pled guilty to a misdemeanor domestic violence dispute in Tennessee, which makes it illegal, since it was domestic violence, for him to be in possession, although he's not a convicted felon, of a weapon. He didn't even know it. And they know he didn't know it, but evidence being used to deny him bond and prosecute him on these really serious charges. Evidence impounded was a copy of Robert F. Williams' Negroes with Guns.
Yeah, the book.
And various,
I think I have a copy of that, like from the late 60s or early 70s. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That thing came out before that.
No, I know, but I was in high school.
You're talking a book that was first published circa 1960.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm talking about when I was in high school.
How old now?
Well, 1960 years? Makes it 68 years this year, yeah.
Yeah, 68 years now.
Yeah.
Oh, when he was arrested, I think it was 67. In any event, two generations in the past, mere possession of the book.
Yeah.
And his speech activities are being invoked. That's it. He's got associations with groups advocating the rights of blacks, like just like the right wingers in this country, to bear arms and defend themselves against armed attack. I mean, that's a position indistinguishable in a lot of ways from the National Rifle Association.
With the exception of a long history of black people actually being murdered that the people in the NRA haven't experienced. They've only read about.
Well, it's the FBI which is running the show in this.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is a thing. This is a bipartisan project, obviously. You know, we're looking at an architecture that's been steadily constructed since the creation of the Bureau of Investigation, really. You had the Obama administration doing the whole sweep that they did against Occupy, for example, where they did all of this illegal intelligence work and then coordinate police activity nationally with local police departments to kick these people out.
Yep.
And just from one party to another.
Total confusion by the so-called left. Okay? Well, what's disarmed then? Oh.
Right.
I wonder why they want you disarmed.
Right.
You've got repression going on overtly, targeting in that, and the so-called left response is to reinforce what it is they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, I don't think they see the connection between trying to take away your gun and telling Iraq that you can't have a weapon to defend yourself, or Korea, or whatever. It's the same exact game with the same enemy.
Yeah. But meanwhile, you got the these militias out doing standoffs with assault weapons, real assault weapons in some cases.
Yeah.
Not what they're passing off as assault weapons, which are lookalikes, but semi-automatic rather than select fire. Okay, out in Utah, and they're taking a seizure of federal land in Oregon. Well, it's not federal land. It belongs to the Indians out there. But in any case, you know, that's the construction put on it, and they're walking away free.
Yeah.
And the FBI is not taking the lead in prosecuting him. Now, this
Well, part of that is that they can't
bias, but it's not what Nancy Pelosi and friends are on about.
Yeah, yeah. There's the idea of these agencies being politicized is stated in simple terms. More or less, that's how you've outlined it. That it's political, but not in the sense that people are concerned about whether it's a Republican or a Democrat or this person or that person in office, but rather that the institution survives and that their relationship to the levers of power remains or improves. Right? Is that fair statement?
I mean, this is an oxymoron. How do you politicize the political police?
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
That's like criminalizing the Capone mob.
Right. Yeah, right. How do you criminalize the mafia? Yeah, so.
You're going to incline these people towards criminal activities. You keep it up.
Yeah.
I mean, they're political. It's a political entity. And performs political functions, but not in the arena that's all the dids are right now.
Right. Right. It's not the apparent, that which is what people are discussing. Right. Professor Ward, thank you.
It's a misdirection, big time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Yes, sir.
Another U.S. aerial attack in Syria, this one with 100 casualties among the Syrians. For more on this, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, analyst and senior lecturer at Moscow State University in International Relations. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow on Friday. All right, Mark, the U.S. is getting kind of brazen again, an attack on the Syrian Arab army inside its own territory.
Yeah, hey, Don, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
Our pleasure.
We have seen a whole range of escalations in Syria over the past 2 or 3 weeks. And this latest attack, this is the U.S. Occupation force in East Syria, in an area where they're primary but not only proxy force is the Kurdish PKK majority rebranded openly. I mean, we're talking U.S. generals openly admitted they decided to rebrand it as the Syrian Democratic Forces because openly working with the PKK was too troublesome to their reputation.
In other words, because it sounds better.
Turkey.
Yeah, it sounds better.
It's better marketing.
Yeah, right.
When you have to sell democracy, trademark democracy, and trademark freedom, then you know the best to use the best, most sophisticated branding.
That's
right. So the details of this attack are extremely murky. The U.S. is claiming the unalienable right of self-defense for their illegal invasion and military occupation of East Syria.
Right.
But it's by the U.S. claims that a Syrian Democratic Forces headquarters location, very very careful wording there, were attacked by Syrian pro-Syrian government forces.
In other words, the Syrian government.
No.
Oh.
Well, they may say it, but this is not what happened at
all. Oh, wow. Okay, so they're being very parsing the language very carefully. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is clear that no Syrian Arab army forces, or very few at least, were involved in this operation. So this all took place east of the Euphrates. The U.S. claims, as part of their partition of East Syria, that they have a gentleman's agreement with Russia and Syria that basically everything east of the Euphrates, at least on that part of Syria, is theirs, while everything west of the Euphrates actually belongs to Syria. It's very nice. Russia and Syria and Iran and everyone else clearly and even Turkey clearly reject this notion and say there is no such agreement. It's simply where the race that we long talked about on this show for territory ended up. And it is not a hard border. There are spaces on both sides of the Euphrates River at various locations that the other side controls. And this happened on the east side of the Euphrates, particularly around an oil field. that the Syrian government would like to regain control of, for obvious reasons, and the U.S. would like to keep out of Syrian government hands for obvious reasons. Right. Just a couple weeks ago, under testimony in the Senate, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Satterfield explicitly said one of our aims there is to deny resources to the Syrian government in order to force the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad to step down, to make life more difficult and miserable for Syrians, and to keep Syria weak, poor, and divided. I mean, that you can't get much more obvious than an open admission of what they're really doing there, as was outright said.
In other words, mm-hmm. they're saying we are occupying this portion of Syria, mm-hmm. of course, without a UN mandate, without an invitation or permission of the Syrian government. We're going to keep it until we can force a regime change in Damascus, regardless of the international community. That is patently illegal, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm not only illegal, it's also very stupid policy, because that's simply not going to happen. And it sacrifices U.S. relations with Turkey and Iraq, which are not happy about the U.S.'s full embrace of Kurdish forces, which they regard as a separatist threat themselves on their own respective sides of the borders. Right. And it's simply not going to happen. They can't deny enough resources. They may not participate in the reconstruction of Syria. No one really asked the people that helped destroy it to participate in the reconstruction anyway. But China, Iran, Russia are certain, and other countries are more than likely to pick up the bill, and it will enjoy the influence and investment that will be involved in the reconstruction.
And the U.S. now, is jacking up the cost of that, of course, by this resource denial, right?
Yeah, the largest. One of the largest remaining pockets of ISIS remaining is actually wedged against U.S. controlled territory in East Syria, up against the Iraqi border. And the U.S. and their proxies have shown no interest in doing anything against them, because it maintains their pretext, which of course they have now expanded on. They've openly said they want regime change in Damascus, even if they're not going to do it by military confrontation with the Syrian government. They want to weaken Iranian influence in the country, because obviously Syria doesn't have the right to form allies with who and what it wants. The U.S. gets to dictate that to other countries in the world. But they're also not finishing the job with ISIS against a weakened pocket that's remaining, without any large urban areas there, simply because they need to maintain a pretext of that's why they're in Syria. Now, the exact area in question that the countering claims of attacks, this oil field, was controlled by a combination of local Arab tribes that had previously been under ISIS, were bought out by the United States. All right. I mean, they may have participated with ISIS because someone had agreed with it. Some of it, may have been done under pressure, and their threat of extermination or so on. They were bought out by the U.S. and that way, that was how the U.S. advanced so quickly on the east bank of the Euphrates, down past Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor, is because they simply bought out ISIS-affiliated tribes, to their side. Now they've gone even further, and they've taken actual ISIS fighters and claimed they've been rehabilitated, the word they use, rehabilitated ISIS fighters. And they have merged several hundred of theirs into their hodgepodge of proxy forces in East Syria. And they may be very well continuing to do that.
Rehab. Rehab for jihadis. Do they use methadone or anything or what?
they're recovering. It's a 12-step program.
Got it.
Yeah. So, This oil field was held by a combination of these local Arab tribes and the SDF. Evidently, these local Arab tribes, not happy as most of the Arabs, in East Syria, are not happy being ruled over by Kurds. They switched sides, evidently, and decided to cooperate at least with the Syrian government. There seems that there was some order by the U.S. to the Syrian Democratic Forces to not resist this and to pull back from the position. It's not clear that there were any U.S. troops there. This may have been a miscommunication. It may have been a deliberate trap. All right? It's not sure. But these local Arab tribes were backed up by other local Arab tribe militias by two towns on the east side of the Euphrates that are actually controlled by the Syrian government. This was, you know, as a result of the race for land, the Syrian government managed to get a foothold at this area on the other side of the Euphrates. It's close by. And then the U.S. claims that the Syrian Democratic Forces attack position was attacked. And they responded with overwhelming firepower.
Yeah, Mattis, meanwhile, said, geez, you know, we have no idea why that happened. We were talking with the Russians and all of that. They knew that the SDF was there. We don't know. He called it perplexing.
Everyone seems to be perplexed. Right. I'm not sure that Mattis is actually the one who is perplexed in this situation.
Yeah, right.
But supposedly, these they called them Syrian affiliated Syrian pro Syrian government forces, mostly local Arab tribes, moved into this area. The U.S. claims it was attacked and responded with overwhelming firepower. They said that one Syrian Democratic Forces proxy was wounded and that they killed 100 of the pro Syrian government. Now that doesn't really sound like an attack and a counterattack to
me,
from my military experience.
Yeah,
but
right.
So the details are not clear, but regardless, of course, that the U.S. has no right, or nor its proxies any right to self-defense in Syrian territory with an illegal invasion and military occupation. This is only the host of a series of escalations in the past 2 weeks. We have seen Erdogan's forces accompanied by his Islamist proxies and actually by allied, literal al-Qaeda forces try to make an advance to cut off Syrian Arab army advances in Idlib. Twice he has been chased off by Syrian artillery and remonstrations from Russia. So this is an actual exchange of fire twice in the past week by Syrian government and Turkish forces. Iran and Syria are increasingly telling the Turkish government to stop their military attack on the Kurdish canton of Afrin, which was previously under a Russian peacekeeping agreement. Russia pulled out ahead of the Turkish advance. And there's a lot of gameplay there between Turkey and the United States. There was also a Russian plane that was shot down over Idlib by Turkish-backed jihadis, in this case a subgroup that was previously armed by the CIA, Jaish al-Nasser, operating under the umbrella, of course, of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham or al-Qaeda in East Idlib. And the pilot parachuted out. It was engaged in a gunfight on the ground and then evidently pulled a pin on a grenade and blew himself up in order to avoid capture, torture, and beheading by the jihadis, saying, "This is for the boys."
Right.
And we know all of this because the jihadis filmed their attack on the down pilot.
Yep. So, all right. So we've got...
And one more. Right.
Yeah.
There was actually two massive drone attacks on Russian military bases that was presented as if it was ad hoc attacks, but the Russian military says it was actually quite advanced and coordinated. It's not exactly clear whether it was U.S.-backed or Turkish-backed or some combination of those. And Russian aid distribution centers and a Russian consulate were also attacked by mortar attacks in the past week. So there's a lot of escalation going on between this three-way Mexican standoff between Russia and the Syrian government on and Iran on one side, Turkey and Al-Qaeda, and it's 31 flavors of jihad on the other, and the U.S., and it's Syrian Democratic Kurdish allied forces on the other. In recent hours, we just have word out, Al-Masdar, it's not being reported on much, so don't take this as a confirmation, you know, but as we're recording, Al-Masdar is reporting that the U.S. forces, backed forces, in this case, the Deir Azor High Military Council, which is actually not part of the Syrian Democratic Forces. It's totally local Arabs that are directly on the paycheck of the U.S. State Department and armed by the Pentagon. So there's no confusion about who they're operating right. are attacking the two Syrian government towns that I mentioned, controlled towns on the east side of the Euphrates in full force as we speak. And this would seem to now be an attempt right after that recent altercation in the same area to drive the Syrian government completely off to the east bank of the Euphrates and firm up the U.S. And their proxy partition of that part of East Syria. I would say, actually, that Russia and the U.S. are both engaged in a type of brinkmanship, not only against each other, but they're each trying to egg the Turks on to attacking the other side. Russia would like the Turks to concentrate, is concentrating on convincing the Turks that the U.S. Alliance with the Kurds is a threat to them, and Turkey should attack the U.S.-supported Kurds in Manbij, while the U.S. would like to split the Turkish Russian geopolitical dance. I don't want to call it an alliance because right. it's anything but this relationship. Austin agreement.
Yeah. We got to stop here, Mark. Thank you very much. Yeah. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. While Washington's political elites chatter endlessly about memos, the U.S. continues to deepen its role in the Syrian proxy war. Of course, there's no public debate about this. And are the two Koreas giving peace a chance? Crosstalking some real news, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Victor Olevich. He is a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And, of course, we have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in any time you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's first talk about what's going on in Syria here. As a avid watcher of cable news in the West, and I don't always enjoy it, but I feel obligated to watch it.
God bless.
The coverage of Syria is very interesting. There's only one angle, primarily, and that's how Trump has defeated ISIS. That is the when you hear about Who? Syria, the president of the United States, believe it or not,
ISIS.
There's almost no mention of the role that Russia has played since September 2015. That was the tipping point. But you know, I'm quibbling, I suppose. But you know. One of the programs I do like to watch is Tucker Carlson. I think he, as a conservative, I can identify with him on many issues. I think he's right on some. I disagree. And he brought on a guest on February 8th to talk about Syria, which was I thought was, you know, I was very happy to hear maybe a critical view of what's going on. He had a guest, and, well, that guest repeated the usual bluster. Let's give it a watch, guys.
You've got Bashar al-Assad, who's obviously a dictator, but he was yeah. against ISIS, too. And now we're fighting him? It seems demented to me, and I bet you if you polled most Americans, they would agree with me.
Well, what I think the administration is doing now and what President Trump is doing now is shifting from ISIS to Iran. And Russia is heavily involved. And, there's a lot of people, I think, rightly asking, why not just let the Russians take care of it? Well, I'll tell you a couple of reasons. One, the Russians don't care about ISIS. They care about defending Assad. Two, they're aligned with Iran. And Iran has made more gains in the last decade under the Obama administration in terms of advancing its hegemony, which is not in the United States' interest or Israel's interest, than they've made in the last 1,000 years. And three, I'll quote a former NATO commander who said the Russians have weaponized refugees, piled them into Europe, allowed ISIS to infiltrate, and have done more to destabilize our partners in Europe than the Warsaw Pact ever did. So I think all of those things, Tucker, in our interest.
With respect, that's just pure propaganda, in my opinion.
Victor, react to that. Because, I mean, we could spend the entire program deconstructing only that one small part of that segment that played on February 8th. Go ahead.
So essentially, Michael Waltz finds himself in a hard spot. Why? Because he has to explain, he has to respond to Tucker Carlson in a very simple question. Assad is fighting ISIS. The United States officially says that it's fighting ISIS. So why is the United States attacking Assad's forces instead of ISIS? Simple question. No simple answer
We got a non-answer. We got a deflection.
It was a deflection because he did not want to say the truth. The official American policy is very different from the real policy that Washington pursues. And the real policy that Washington pursues is aimed at eliminating Assad as the leader of Syria. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that ISIS flourished in Syria. Without the support that the anti-Assad forces initially got from the U.S., from Britain, some other countries, some other allies of the U.S., ISIS would not have flourished in Syria.
Well, I mean, if there hadn't been the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003, it never would have happened here.
And Iran would not be so influential. That's what he says. You know, Iran has been gaining more influence, spreading its hegemony than in
why?
The last month.
Let's be clear to our viewers. Is it because of what Iran is doing or what other actors are doing?
Because what
obviously
the US has
it is
done.
Other actors.
Well, if it had not been for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 1991, if it had not been for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, Iran would have never been so influential. It's as simple as that. Even the mainstream media.
And the constant attempts to combat what they ludicrously call Iranian hegemony, which is simple, the fact that Iran has some influence against the overwhelming Middle East hegemony of the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, this tripod alliance. They refuse to allow any other country, particularly a weak country like Syria, to be allied with Iran. Right. The U.S. decides who is allowed to be allied with who and who isn't allowed to be allied with who. And they never noticed that all their attempts to roll back some fictional Iranian influence
Iranian hegemony. I mean, just think about that. Yeah. Who's really the hegemon here, okay?
Not only that, but their continual efforts in Syria and directed against Iran, they have pushed Russia and Iran
closer
and Russia,
together.
Iran, and China closer together. The Russian government years ago wouldn't have wanted to be caught dead in bed with Iran. Now they find they have so many geopolitical interests in common and they can deal with them so professionally compared to the Westerners we're looking at another de facto strategic partnership.
It's interesting when you compare maybe Russia's relationship with Iran and how it has to negotiate on a baby step level with Turkey, for example.
The Russian relationship both with Iran and with China, it really grew. Not during Putin's time, of course it grew more, but it started growing in the 1990s when the Westernist Yeltsin was the president of Russia. It wasn't because Yeltsin was anti-American, he wasn't. It wasn't because his administration was somehow against Washington, it wasn't. It was because it was a natural relationship, the United States pushing Pax Americana, wanting to be the only superpower in the world and not letting anyone else have a voice. It was consolidating other powers in this fight of U.S. against
because with the end of the communist ideology, Russia actually began realizing its own real national interests. It wasn't blinded by ideological goggles here. Go ahead.
But I'm returning to this hilarious video. I mean, when Michael Waltz says that we must counter Iranian influence, who kidnapped the Lebanese prime minister and kept him against his will in Riyadh for several weeks? Iran? Oh, no, it happened to be Saudi Arabia, but we forgot about it. Who just bombed the Syrian forces, killing 100 Syrian soldiers uninvited?
That's where I want to go here on this. Okay.
Oh, no.
But I'm glad we're dovetailing into that. Mark, we have this Israeli jet that crashed. We don't know exactly what happened to it. But I was really fascinated, but it was predictable, how the Israelis and Washington mimicking what Tel Aviv's talking points were. It's all about Iran. Okay, here is a country that, you know, the United States attacks pro-government forces in Syria. Over 100 people are killed. And then we have this jet that goes down. We don't know exactly what the circumstances are. But then the talking point is it's Iran's fault. They're going after Iranian assets in Syria.
Israel has admitted in recent hours that it was brought down by Syrian air defense, right? Yeah, Israel presents as their justification for their most recent attack on Syria. And let's be clear. When we're talking, Israel uses the excuse of defense, self-defense, and everything.
Well, that's what Mattis is saying also.
Yeah, well, that's what the
U.S. is claiming. Both of them are.
Yeah, while militarily invading and occupying East Syria. Israel has attacked Syria over 100 times since 2011. In fact, they call it the promenade, the idea that Israeli fighters just own Syrian airspace
and can
fire on and Lebanese and do whatever they want there. Well, this has come to an end as of yesterday.
Okay, is this an escalation or is it sending a very strong signal? And what is Russia's role in this? Because there is some kind of debate here that one of them is that Damascus has had enough, considering what Mark just said there, that they are going to start reacting here. Or is it the Russians and the Iranians whispering in Assad's ear? I tend to think the Syrians are saying enough is enough. They will strike back.
Look, when the Syrian civil war started in 2011 in Deraa and then spread to other regions of Syria with the support of the West, with the support of the United States, Israel and the Israeli leadership was sure that the opposition would win and that Assad would lose. He would go, and then a pro-American regime would come in Damascus, and somehow...
Just like Libya.
Just like Iraq.
And so for years, Israel has supported certain radical Islamic formations in Syria. This is not a secret. Even Israeli newspapers like Haaretz have written about Islamic fighters being taken to
medical
Israeli
health.
Hospitals.
ISIS fighters.
Yes,
ISIS.
Indeed. And other groups too. Mm-hmm. And now, in the last few years, after Russia turned the tide in Syria, and it is now obvious to everyone in the field that Assad is going to stay. He is not going to go, no matter how many pronouncements about that are going to be made by Trump, by Pence, by Tillerson, or anyone else, for that matter. Israel is now faced with a very different situation. So Israel now understands that, contrary to what Tel Aviv expected, Iranian influence in Syria is not going to decrease, but it is going to increase. And Israel now wants a stake in the future of Syria.
Well, and that's why the U.S. is staying there, because they want a stake in the future. Before we go to the break.
Yes, well, let me just look at it from another angle. I mean, they keep talking about Israel's security. Well, before the Syrian war, the Golan Heights was the quiet backwater of Israel. Tourist groups were taken
there.
The
Golan Heights is Syrian territory.
It's illegally occupied by Israel.
But talking about Israel's security, tourists were taken there. It was the safest location in Israel. Now, it's a war zone. Why? Because the Israeli government, together with Western governments, decided to do some regime change in Syria. And now they're crying that Iran is spreading its influence. You know, Mr. Netanyahu comes to Moscow to negotiate that Russians would somehow pressure Iran not to spread into that area. They have themselves to blame for starting that war.
If there's any
I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen, here, and we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with our team.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, Mark, before we went to the break, you want to finish up what we were talking about with Syria and Iran?
In Syria, this is the whole situation is escalating so quickly. We've had at least one Israeli jet shot down, right, in most recent hours. We've had pro-Syrian government Arab tribes in East Syria attacked by the United States, and over 100 of them killed. There's rumors about whether Russian security contractors were killed as well. That's unconfirmed as of yet. We had one or possibly two Turkish helicopters shot down over Afrin by the Kurdish forces that are resisting the Turkish invasion of Syria there. And we have a Russian fighter that was shot down by a manpad. This follows multiple drone swarm attacks on Russian military bases. The Syrian conflict is at a point of escalation and crisis that we haven't even seen before. The low-hanging
but
fruit of ISIS.
But you wouldn't really know that if you were watching cable network news.
What Israel and the U.S. really show is that if there's anyone that has a right of self-defense, it is Syria against Israel, the United States, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and so on.
There's another very short point to it, another reason for this escalation. On March 18th, there are going to be presidential elections in Russia. It is a very well-known date in the United States and other Western capitals. And one of the things they're trying to do these days is to discredit the Russian position as much as they can before the election. So in the next month and a half, we will see more of this, more of these attempts to propaganda, information war, attacks on Russian interests around the world, not just in Syria. Everything is possible.
Okay. Well, I just can say that don't forget about Russian meddling in U.S. elections when you see direct U.S. meddling in Russian elections, okay?
Don't worry. We'll probably later in the week we'll go back to a memo gate. There's going to be more memos coming out. But I want to talk about some diplomacy and optics, Mark, the opening of the Olympic Games. Who's the winner and who's the loser from an optics point of view? Go ahead.
Peace.
Peace is the winner.
The sight of the two Koreas, the North Korean delegation entering South Korea and marching together the Olympics under a unification flag.
Without the border.
This was incredible. And there's one point person on scene who was extremely upset by this and had to give his protest against peace. And that was the U.S. President Mike Pence.
Vice President.
I'm sorry. Freudian slip.
That could go down in history. Okay. Right. Mark knew. Okay.
He refused to stand up for the host.
Right.
South Korea, because it was a joint unification team, he refused to shake hands with any of the North Korean delegates. He had this look on his face, and actually the side eye that Kim Jong-un's sister, who is leading the North Korean delegation, sitting behind Mike Pence, gave him, that's gone viral over the internet, shows, I think, you know, for once, the world with North Korea's side on this, showing disgust at the U.S. Throwing a tantrum on even the prospect that some peace gestures are being made in the Korea. So it's disgusting.
You know, Victor, I mean, the North Korean leader, otherwise known by some people as Rocket Man, is turning into be quite a adroit diplomat, wouldn't you say?
A much more adroit diplomat than somebody who has been for years positing himself as a deal maker and writing a book, Art of the Deal. Well, what has Trump said for the past year? Almost every day, Twitter, speeches, writings, and so forth.
On the floor of the General Assembly of the United Nations.
Yes, exactly, that grotesque speech in front of the General Assembly. Locked and loaded, ready to attack.
Fury.
Exactly. Almost every single day on a daily basis. And Trump, essentially, and his administration kept saying that the United States will not negotiate with North Korea until and unless Pyongyang gets rid of its nuclear program and so forth. Pyongyang has not compromised on a single negotiating issue, not on a single one. Mm-hmm. And what has happened? It has been able to negotiate with South Korea to come into the Olympics as a single team. Now Kim Jong-il...
We may have a visit.
Exactly. He has just invited the new South Korean president to North Korea. Yeah. A historic visit if it happens. And why has this happened? The main reason is that both South and North Korea, they do not want a war on the Korean
Peninsula.
So you're
telling me that they know their own national interests.
Yes,
remarkable.
Better than the neocons in the U.S. do.
And their common
sure.
national interest is not to kill hundreds of thousands of millions of Koreans, either in the north or the south.
Nima.
Well, I think we should at least mention on this program that no Russian flags were allowed at this Olympic ceremony, that the Russian team actually had to march as Olympic athletes from Russia in neutral clothes. And I think, let me play here a devil's advocate, I think it's a good development because there were many people in Russia who did not receive the message from the West, you know, who said that the Russian television is exaggerating, they're not so hostile. Okay, you've got sanctions, you've got the Kremlin list, you've got threats of war. Now, if you didn't get that, look at your Olympic athletes, you know, in neutral clothes. Look at the Russian flag being banned. And if you don't take, if you don't, you know, make conclusions out of that, sorry, you are just blind.
Look, one short development before that, just days before the Olympic Games started, the sports court, international sports court in Lausanne, in Switzerland, acquitted
28
Russian athletes.
Yes.
And then the International Olympic Committee said still, even though they have been cleared, they're not going to let them go. This got appealed to the same court.
To force IOC to take them.
And the court said, after IOC threatened it, the court said,
No, they've been cleared, but they can't come.
For no reason.
The court said that there is no evidence that these 28 Russian athletes did any doping. That were involved in it anyway, and still the International Olympic Committee, that's still clearly dominated by Western political machinations here, denied them coming, simply because they're Russian.
The hilarious thing is that the court said there is no evidence that these Russians used doping, but there is no evidence that IOC was partial to them. So they can't go.
This is Rusophobia, and it's worse.
Yes, but I think it's still a good development. Sports is not life. Sports is about imitating life, preparing yourself for difficulties. So if Russians don't get the message now, then we are simply not worthy of the dangers.
Well, it seems to me, Victor, it's just destroying the Olympic tradition. Okay, I mean, you can criticize, you know, it's all about money and it's about sponsors, you know, and all the big sports franchise, you know. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's about individuals competing against others, and that layer is being peeled away, and it's delegitimizing.
And it
I have to wonder. Let's take those 28.
Yes, 28 athletes who were
kicked. How are the athletes when they conduct their games? Is it going to be in the back of their head? Is it, well, you know, the best person in this field is not on the field right now? Well, it cheapens every single medal.
You are right.
That
but
is
this is
one.
This is the most horrible thing. You know, the British team advocated a total ban on the Russian team at the Rio Games. The same voices were heard about these games. You know, the problem is North Korea did not compromise on anything, and their team is in South Korea.
That's
Russia
why
compromised
there.
On everything. We said we are going to clear up our RUSADA, you know, the anti-doping agency in Russia. We made every compromise with the International Olympic Committee. What did we get?
No,
look at this ceremony.
When you compromise,
you lose.
Then you lose.
Absolutely.
And they look at it as appeasement.
The more you accommodate, the more they will take.
Regardless of this, I mean, the U.S. may have won a temporary, petty political victory here, but regardless, Russia still has the third largest contingent at these Olympics.
What does the medals chart look like? I mean, South Korea, Norway, and then blank?
No, how do they do this? Rather than writing Russia, they're writing Olympic athletes from Russia.
From
with
Russia.
United. Everyone knows who those medals belong to. And at the end of this Olympics, according to the agreements that have been made, if Russia abides by all of this banning of their flag and their anthem and everything, at the end of the Olympics, Russia, with its medals intact, will be able to march under the Russian flag.
It's actually not a done deal yet. And there is some speculation that at the last minute,
they
may not allow it.
This is about sports.
No, it's not. The Olympics has never been about sports. It's always been about politics, Peter. Geopolitics.
Not always, but at least since the last 40 years, it has not been about sports. It was about politics. Let's face it. And I think, you know, the stupidity of the American side, I think Mark is not quite right about them gaining a victory. They wanted people in Russia to hate Putin because our athletes did not go to
Under their own flag.
Okay, what they got is Russian people hating IOC and the United States, I mean, not the United States, but their elite, for doing all of these ugly things to our athletes. That's the complete opposite of what they wanted to achieve.
We're almost out of time for this segment here. Gentlemen, I want to go back to the possible rapprochement of the two Koreas. Victor, what is the next step? I mean, I started out this part by talking about the optics of it. What's the next step to really to gain on these optics?
The most important step for South Korea and for North Korea in this is to get the United States out of these negotiations.
Absolutely. They're not going to be out completely, of course, especially considering American influence, the influence that Washington exercises in South Korea, in Seoul. But to get the U.S. as far out of these negotiations as possible. And the farther the U.S. is out of there, the more chance there is to make agreements, both in the humanitarian sphere, in the military sphere, in border issues and other issues, family reunification issues, and the less chance there is for armed conflict on the peninsula.
25 seconds.
As with the situation in Israel-Palestine, North Korea, South Korea, the biggest obstacle to a genuine successful peace process is U.S. interference, U.S. pursuit of hegemony using this divide and conquer rule in both places. It is in U.S. interest, hegemonic interest, to keep both conflicts going.
Divide and conquer, the old Roman rule.
Yeah.
Okay, gentlemen, many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.